says, Lockheed P-2 Neptune aircraft, and this has lots of common words like Jet, Douglas, Skyhawk, Cars, that wouldn't be it. This one over here, Manitoba, no, I don't think so. So maybe. I mean, it could be similar by the pretext description. It could be similar by a controlled vocabulary description. Could be that similar people looked at it. But if we wanted to look at the content, what's similar about all those pictures?
They're all
colors. They've got the blue at the top, and then something kind of browny, blackish in the middle, and then something sort of browny, gray at the bottom.
Okay. And so colors are similar. What else?
They are phytoplankton.
They're so
it could be them actually visible. Yes.
Yeah, so
all the plants are on the ground.
Maybe
that's
the
very interesting.
And maybe the resource that could be same or similar resource. The received resource the URL maybe the same.
Maybe from similar places, but they're not. But they're not. But they're all military planes. There's something funny about that. We didn't get any airliners parked on the ground. Right? But they're all on the ground. That's another interesting thing, right? So, but they can all be explained as on the ground because the ground is brown, right? So the color kind of gives us the ground. They're all pointy.
Actually, the second match is the exact match. They are even pointed the same way.
No.
Maybe the description is the same.
Maybe, but what's going on here is
there's some similar shapes going on if you look at the airplanes, and that's when you said they're military and not airliners, they don't look like an airliner would with sort of a more tubular shape to it.
Except for the one you started with.
Oh well.
I kind of feel like I was going to say with Justin about the background and the colors, but I kind of feel like maybe there's both going on here. Is looking at some of the metadata and also comparing the shapes and colors, because there's no pickup truck with a blue background or something similar to an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's other similar shapes to an airplane purely to pick it up.
Okay, so we could look at, we can certainly look at metadata and stuff like that, but we can also look just in the content at what the colors are. Yeah. We can also look at where the colors are, so blue's on the top, brown's on the bottom. We can look at what kind of shapes we have. Do we have pointy shapes, or do we have rounded shapes? We can look at, is it horizontal or vertical? We didn't get any rocket ships, right? And so there are lots of different kinds of features that we can pull out of this. Okay. Trouble is, this is very expensive. So they stopped doing it. Okay, so the way that one was done was just with color. The way you represent an image, it's a bunch of dots. Every dot has a color, and typically there are lots and lots and lots of colors. So it wouldn't be uncommon in the monitors you have in front of you to have 256 different shades of red, green, and blue, the so-called 24-bit color, 3 8-bit color indication. And if you, for every dot, and that means that nothing would ever be the same color. Anything that's just a little bit different, there's 65 million different combinations there. Anything that's just a little bit different wouldn't match. So what we do is we say, well, all of those blues, they're blue. All right? So we'll just kind of mush the blues down to blue, the reds down to red. We'll get it down to some reasonable number. And this is done with color quantization algorithms. And you can cut colors up a whole lot of ways, but typically for this kind of matching, they take it down to 256 colors. Now think about what I have. I previously had 100,000 words laid out in a vector, and I looked for other documents that have the same pattern of usage of words, right? So I had things like a BM25 and language models and TF-IDF with cosine normalization. I had all these different ways of comparing vectors. for a vector was a set of values. Now what I've got is I've got a set of 256 values. And I want to compare it to some other set of 256 values. So I just do exactly the same thing. I could just compute the cosine. Okay. So, for example, there's what happens when you search a system that's still available on the web at this URL. So at this URL, if you go to it, when you click on one of these, they will no longer be there because all the links that they crawled died long ago. But the service is still there and you can still see the color histogram. So I picked a couple of those, Godzilla in the upper right and Godzilla in the middle left. Right? And so here are two different Godzillas. This one has got some yellow and some black and some red. And you can see that the red is high. This is just a visualization of the vector. The black is high. It's a little hard to see, but that's why they put the little cigarette tip under the top. Right? And then there's a little bit of other colors that is found here, mostly from the fact that you get a little bit of color striation. So then the question is this histogram similar to this histogram? So here's our friend Godzilla, right, in flesh this time. And you can see Godzilla's got a bunch of browns. And so we get a bunch of browns. And Godzilla's got some greens. So we get some greens. You get the idea. Yes? And then you can ask the question, how similar are these two histograms? Since I'm multiplying them together and adding them up. And the answer would be, you couldn't use one of these to find the other based on color similarity. Okay. Now you see we've lost any idea that the blue is at the top here and the green is on the side, and you know, there's no location, there's no shape. And so this was the sort of first attempt that people came up with for this. And you can go use this system and hit the button and do similarity searching, and if you're patient enough, it'll find you similar looking images. Okay. Now, there's something else that was going on here. You see, if you went and like petted Godzilla here, you'd find that he was kind of rough, right? Or she, I never could figure out whether it was a he or she. But if you ran your hand across that, you wouldn't find that kind of roughness. Right? So there's some kind of roughness going on here. Now, you can have lots of different kinds of roughness. So, for example, you can have roughness that goes this way, or roughness that's kind of even, or roughness that's kind of all over the place, or roughness that goes that way. Right? So some of these have an orientation to them, and some of them don't. And so you can make a representation of the roughness of the image overall, or you can make a representation of the roughness of the image in a region of the image that's of a consistent color. So you could use the color and the roughness together to start to segment out regions. Yes? Okay, now these are done with mathematical models that characterize the orientation and the scale, right? So this is at a different scale than that. So they just create more vectors, right? So we get vectors that characterize color, vectors that characterize roughness. Okay. Now, if we want to try to figure out where an object is, I just took Photoshop for this, just to give you an idea how you would use color. And I clicked in here and I said, fill this with sickening yellow. And it filled everything with sickening yellow, except it didn't do this part here, and it didn't do all this part here, and it didn't do that part there, right? So it's filling what was white with yellow. So it doesn't really know where the whale is, all it knows where is where the white is. But you can see that it's captured a region here that's associated with an object. Now, if we were to do the texture, we'd find out that the texture of the whale is different from the texture of the background. You see all this horizontal stuff going on in the background here? Whereas in the whale, if we had any direction, it would be this direction. So when we use texture and color together, we can start to find regions. Okay. So here's one of the more sophisticated techniques that in which people have done this. So here's a picture of the tiger. Now, every time you read these people's papers, they always use tigers for their examples. And so you get the idea that this thing is particularly good on tigers and probably, you know, has no particular advantage on lighthouses or barber poles or other things that you might think of. So don't get too carried away with this being the ultimate solution. But nonetheless, this tiger has got a set of characteristics. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick a spot and we're going to draw an oval. So they cleverly call this blob rule. So we're going to get a bunch of blobs that together define the picture. All right? So what we do is we take the picture, which I can't quite reach here, and we pick a spot. Okay, I can pick a spot there. And then we say, okay, how wide is that spot and how high is that spot? Right? So we get in geek speak the semi-major axis and the semi-minor axis, and we draw the oval. Okay? Then we say, okay, what color is that spot, and what texture is the spot? Right? So every, and what orientation is it? So you can see here, we picked this spot here, and that gives us that, that oval. We've got the tiger, of course. We've got a bunch of green around the background, somewhat different shades of green because of the way the camera's working. All right? Now.
Are those in? I'm sorry, are those in? What's
so they're picked in order to be the most distinguishing areas. Right? So if I picked this corner here or that corner there, it wouldn't be quite as good as picking that corner there. It'd be more representative. All right, so they're trying to pick spots that describe the picture. And then they're going to pick a shape. They're going to pick a color, texture, and an orientation. Set of colors, texture, and orientation. And then you can tell it, okay, it's really important. See, all the rest of these, you simply gave us the picture, right? I mean, realize how weak this was. We said airplane, we got an airplane. We said, more like that one. And we're stuck in more like that one's face. There's no way to say, oh no, big airplane, fast airplane, right? I mean, you can start over again, but these pictures may not be well described by text. So we're in the image domain. We have no way to talk to the image domain. There's no way to tweak our query. So they're trying to help us out here, and they're trying to say, okay, well, how much do you care about this blob? You know, and if you're thinking, well, I want a tiger, then you really care about that blob. I mean, if that's not there, you know, you got a nice picture of sand. Right? Okay, so you tell it that blob is very important. And what's important about that blob? Well, the color is really important, the texture is very important. The location is not so important. I don't really care if the tiger is jumping or if the tiger is lying down. I just want a tiger, please. And I don't care if it's a small tiger seen from a long way away or a, you know. So, but you see how you could emphasize or de-emphasize some characteristics of this. All right, and then you might have some other one, like how do you feel about this green? And you're like, well, you know, green's okay. I don't, you know, tiger on green stuff. Green's nice. I don't care so much, you know, if it's grass or just a blob of green. And I really don't care where it is, right? Or what color you have, what shape you happen to think the green is. that way of specifying a query was so arcane that you can't find this on the internet anymore.
So what if we have a tiger and a baby tiger, and they're both in blocks, but I want more of the baby tiger?
Well, then you better hope the thing's got two different blocks.
Would it, normally?
Well, if the baby tiger wasn't directly in line with the tiger, I mean, it depends. If you got a back view of the baby tiger, you know, sitting over here, we got a baby tiger, there you got a full, you know, full-size tiger, then you got a chance the thing will make two blocks. Right? If you're a side view, who knows? If the baby tiger happens to be jumping at that moment and is right in front of the other tiger, you might not get a second block. But you could then search for other pictures with tigers, some of which would have back views of baby tigers, maybe. And then you'd be in business, because then you could do more like that. Right? That would be their claim anyway. So you can't go creating your own ovals here. Right? They create the ovals, and then you can talk about the ovals. They're essentially trying to give you a language here for discussing something visual. The problem is that their language is coming very close to their processing. Right? It's as if when I gave you a text-oriented search, I could say, well, here, I picked out of the document you like these six words. Here, tell me how much you like each of those six words. You know, it's that kind of a search that's going on here. So you're getting more control, but at the price of thinking more like a machine. Does somebody else have a question?
Well, why don't they let you just try your own?
I don't know. Things designed to be worked on the web and drawn ovals on the web might have seemed hard to them at the time. Right? Whereas all this is done well. Yeah, there's no reason why you couldn't pick a light pen down and say, you know, here, I really care about the nose of this tiger. I want things with noses. Okay. And so you can see what they get when they search what the search I just did. They find, you know, tigers looking this way, tigers looking that way. It's not perfect. But you can see it really does look like a tiger to the machine. Right? So it kind of gives you an idea what the machine is representing.
Can't they combine it with the shape recognition, the boundaries of the...
So that's the next thing you would try to do, right, is you would try to say, well, all these have been very simple pictures. Maybe we can pick this one as an example. Here's a tiger and here's a rock. And what I really like to do is I'd like to say, okay, well, here's the boundary of the tiger, right? And then this thing down here, this is a rock. It's got its own texture and stuff like that. So not two blobs, but two actual objects. If I wanted to do that, how many objects are there in the background of this picture?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Do you have a way of turning off all the lights?
Even the tiger would be two objects. The hand itself might
be. No, it can
be
Yeah, or maybe you get the ears as a separate object.
But I have seen simple photo editing software which tell you the exact boundary of the, if my picture means, I'm not saying it will do a search, but it tells the exact boundary.
Yeah, but it knows, for example, for a head, yeah. Right? But it has trouble in this room, right?
Yeah.
You know, because there's just an awful lot of shapes. So where people test this out is pictures of houses with fences. Right? Fences you can see through. Now finding the object. And so there is work that's done on that. And when you get that, then the next thing that you can do is you can say, okay, well, now that I have these objects, what's the relative position of the objects? Right? So I'm interested in finding things that have not just a tiger and a man with a gun, but the man with the gun pointing the gun at the tiger. So now we need to know position, orientation, and then we have a problem that, well, if I just rotate the camera a little bit, right, then everything's changed in the picture, but people see it as the same. And so you need to start representing things relative to each other. And then if I have a zoomed out picture, everything looks like it's much closer together, right? So you need to find a representation of the geometry that doesn't fix you into a scale, so it's scale invariant, and it doesn't fix you into a rotation, so it's rotationally invariant. But you can't let it be too rotationally invariant, otherwise you'll have the upside down picture of the airplane. I suppose it's sometimes the case, right? The airplane is sometimes upside down, usually after a problem. Okay. Like the wind down here today. Other questions on that? So you have the idea. You already knew how to do this, you just didn't know it, right? I mean, it was just a matter of thinking about color histograms and you were done. And then there was that trick about the texture, and then there's the trick about the regions. Essentially, the three regions. Good? Okay. So, multimedia is pretty easy. It's simply everything you've learned the entire semester, right? Because you've got the audio channel, you've got the picture sitting here flipping, right? You've got maybe some closed caption text, so you can search that, that's pretty easy. So essentially you get everything that we've talked about. So the interesting thing in multimedia is twofold. What happens when we have moving pictures rather than still pictures? And how do we put everything together? So far we've talked about the structure of the image, but now we've got three kinds of motion that are going to happen. One is, there might be something moving in the picture, right? So we got a picture, and it's a picture, I don't know, they're playing baseball, and they pitch the baseball, they hit the baseball's sitting here moving all over the place, and you don't get credit as a sports director unless the baseball's on the screen, right? So we got this moving baseball on the screen. Now the camera's moving around, so the baseball may not actually be moving in the screen. Everything else is moving, and that's because of the second problem, which is camera motion. So we're going to have to tell the difference between camera motion and object motion. Okay. And then the third one is just when you think you've got this down, somebody brings some cameras. Right? And so now we're switching from one camera to another. And of course, we can switch from one camera to another in a lot of different ways. Okay, let's see if I can. Imagine that you have a camera, a digital camera, and you've taken a picture of this. And then I move it just a little bit, and you take another picture. And I move it a little bit further, and you take another picture. Then, if you take all those pictures and line them up, what you would see is that on this side of the object, we are creating darker spots, assuming it's light behind this thing, right? Or lighter spots, it's dark behind this thing. We're changing the color on this side, and we're changing the color on this side. Yes? So here, we're creating picture elements. And here, we're destroying picture elements from the perspective of the camera. So that's what object motion looks like. That's what a linear translation looks like. Yes? Okay. Now, if I'm rotating it, then you've got the creation is occurring on this side, the destruction is occurring on this side, things are going off your view on this side, but there's no horizontal translation going on, right? The thing's still in the same place, but we've got the colors changing, again, this side and that side. So we can separate translation and rotation, and we can analyze the rotation of the object. Now, I can move my camera one of two ways. I can either zoom it in, zoom it out, and do that by physically moving the camera or just by adjusting the lens. In which case, if I do a frame-to-frame analysis, what I see is there's some spot where everything is moving towards or moving away from, right, which is the point the camera was focused on. So I see these picture elements getting mapped in or mapped out, right? And everything in the picture is moving at the same time. So it's really easy to tell the difference between camera motion, automatically, and object motion. Yes? Have I lost half of you?
Unless the whole scene is somehow physically moving towards or
Yes, okay. So if it's a painting and the camera's sitting here and it's moving away, right? And I'm zoomed in on it.
Yeah, it affects the same as camera.
The effect would be the same as the camera. Okay, but you have the basic idea that I can tell the difference between the motion of the object and the motion of the camera. Yes? Yeah?
I'm following what you're saying, but I'm thinking of motion picture where there is a camera and we think it's the object moving, meaning...
Yeah, they're trying to fool you.
Yeah.
Same thing we were just talking
about. Exactly. So yeah. It's like in reality, no, we can't really tell. And
you can be fixed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. But in general, if I have a natural scene,
yeah,
imagine the baseball game, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Now, why would I care about being able to tell the motion of the camera and the motion of the objects? Why would I need to know this?
Because we can create the second frame based on the first frame, therefore reducing the size of...
So I might want to do this for coding, right? There are certain kinds of transitions that can occur in physics, and there are other things that can't occur. So for example, MPEG, the video coding standard, uses the fact that things can get created on one side and not created on another side, and it sets up a model of the velocity, and it says, okay, we seem to be creating black pixels over here, so let's go creating black pixels over here at a certain rate until I tell you different. Right? So we could use it for coding. But for search, how would we use it? Yeah?
I'm going back to the image search where you were saying showing more like that, and I assume with video or multimedia you kind of want to do something like that. So if you want to see the baseball, it helps to know if the baseball is moving or if it's just something focusing in and out. So you can tell, so you can have something to compare it to.
Okay, so I think you're very close to the answer to how to use this for search. The only thing you know right now is how to search for images, right? If I give you a video and I tell you the only thing you know is how to search for images, how do you know which of the frames to search for? You want to select a frame, right? Which frame do you want to select? Well, I don't know, maybe the one with the baseball in the middle of it. With the batter swinging the bat, or whatever. So you want to have some model for where, which spot to pick for the frame to focus on. A really good example is if I have 10 programs and I want to show you, let's say there are 10 news stories, and I want to show you on these 10 news stories a picture that is representative of what you should see, and I just pick at random from within the news story, I will get the talking head of the announcer almost all the time. Because the talking head of the announcer shows up someplace in the news story, right? Often for a long time. And then we cut to a little, you know, scene of a riot in Lord knows where, and then we're back to the talking head. So if I'm just picking randomly, I'll show you, you know, oh, here's a news story, talking head. Here's a news story, same talking head. Here's a news story, same talking head. But if I want to pick a really good picture, I want to have an idea where the action's happening. All these people running or something, right? That's better than the talking head. Yes?
And you want to do the opposite. You don't want what is mostly in the video.
That's right, because what's mostly in the video is uninformative. It's low IDF. Inverse head frequency or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, I want to show you something representative of the story.
Sure. I don't see how knowing the difference between camera motion and off-face motion and composition.
Well, so there are certain kinds of stories where I want to show you the point where people are moving. Right? But I don't want to show you the point where the camera's moving. I want to show you the point where things are happening on the screen. There's an opposite stage in drama. Anybody here study drama? So there was one guy who studied drama who then went off and became an electrical engineer and started building systems, which is really weird. And what he noted was that people who create videos are taught to focus the viewer's attention by having, you know, all the things are happening and everybody gets in the room and they're just yelling at each other, the camera's moving, and then everything stops, and that's sort of the moment and it's captured your attention. So what you actually care about is the point where everything stops. The object's not moving, the camera's not moving, this is, you know, in a dramatic production, this is the focus of the moment. Right? And that's the key frame that you want to pick.
So you care about the point at which the motion is most different from all the motion that happens in all the other frames.
Well, I mean, in drama, you care about that. In football games, they have the wide shot, everybody's running around getting set up, and then they have the narrow shot. You always want the narrow shot for the summary of what's happening in your football game. Because the wide shot just looks like a football field with a bunch of people on it. The motion is interesting, but the shot is just a shot of the football field. You don't always want the wide shot.
But even if one topic, you might want, for example, if we're looking for a falling star, then we want the object to be moving.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if, for example, we want to see a star closer, then the camera would be the thing that's moving.
Well, but you want the camera to stop moving.
And you know in each one what we want.
Well, so if I were doing news, I gave you an example of, you know, I want the action going on, not with the camera, but with people running or whatever's happening that's being photographed, not just people standing there. If we're doing drama, we want the stopped point. But you have to decide in advance which one you want, and then this would get it right. So if you don't know what you're searching, this wouldn't be helpful.
It seems to me like it's almost like a collection of, I guess, points in whatever the data, meaning you're probably not looking for a point in time, but if you knew that you wanted a zoom in of a star, then mm-hmm. you'd probably look for the images building up, so okay, getting closer, and then it would know where that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess the videotape, so to speak. If you wanted a lot of action on the news story between the talking heads, let's say you want the top of it, so you'd want it to start from right after a still image when movement starts again up on the, you know, so you can almost capture the middle of the action versus the beginning of the action based on, I guess, the image changes the first time. So the same composition for a long time versus quickly changing composition.
Right, so the key to the entire thing is you have to decide what you want, and then these are ways of telling when you have it. Let me give you another example. One of the things that you can do is when they put up on the screen and it says, I used to use Benjamin Netanyahu, but I guess I'm supposed to use Ehud Olmert now. But somebody's name, right? Here's the face. And we put up the name, right? the next time we see the face, we might not have the name on the screen. But I know who that is because I could actually OCR on the screen the name. Right? And then next time I see the face, I can do face recognition. Right? And I can associate that face with that name. And therefore, if you want to find all the pictures of that person, once I use the video OCR, the on-screen OCR, to get you the name, then I can get you that person just based on the face. But in order to do that in video, I do face recognition very badly if I do profiles. I have to be dead on the face. So how do I find out if I'm dead on? What I do is I find the eyes, and I find the cheeks. So the cheeks are a bright spot, and the eyes are a dark spot. And I look for the time when the eyes are the furthest apart, and the cheeks are the furthest apart. And that's when they're looking straight into the camera. And that's the frame I take. And then run it through face recognition. Yeah, so you have to have something you're trying to get. And then all of this image processing to tell you when you have that.
How can they come up with these? How did they come up with these?
What do you mean?
I mean, something like, well,
they came to class. I mean, how did they know that your eyes are furthest apart when you're looking at the camera?
How did it come to their mind that this is what we want to do for face recognition?
Oh, so they tried to make face recognition systems. And they tried them with faces that had different orientations, and they found out that they worked best when they were straight on. With batch evaluations, right? Just like you're doing this week. Yes, that's what you need. You take pictures, and you label them all with the people, and you see what the pattern of mistakes is. You say, hey, I like the ones that are straight on best. I mean, they do this with you when you're in the airport, right? Have you ever been coming up an elevator and there's a little red light up at the top of the elevator, and you look up at the red light, and you see there's a camera there. Do you know why they put the red light there? So you look at it. You think I'm kidding? Try that at the airport next time.
Yep.
Right. So there are two ways to do it. One is you can let people look wherever they want and find when their beady little eyes are as far apart, or you stick a light there and they'll look. Okay.
But if we are saying that the picture recognition is costly, then going through a 3-hour video to find the possible frames is much, much more costly. And if you have 1,000 videos, it will be like exponentially costly.
Yeah, so it's really nice if you can do this stuff in the compressed domain, so you're processing fewer bits. So there are lots of these tricks where at first people figure out how to do it, and then they try to do it without decompressing the MPEG. So they just run on the video stream. Because what MPEG is they send you the picture, and then they send you the pixels that changed. Right? And if it's MPEG 4, they send you the pattern of change of the pixels, and then errors in the pattern of the change of the pixels over time. So they don't just tell you, in one case they tell you what the pixels are, and then they tell you how they've changed. That's MPEG 1 or MPEG 2. But in MPEG 4, they tell you what trajectory the pixel change is. So here's a dark pixel and it's moving this way at this rate. And then if that ever changes, they tell you about the error. So they get the coding down as well as they can. So you'd like to be able to do as much of the processing in that domain as you can. But the essentially, this is all very expensive stuff. Okay, here's another fun thing you can do. Let's say, so we can tell now when two shots are the same, when two images are the same, right? So when we get the talking head, what do you think the talking head's color histogram looks like? Same thing it did last time. Same thing it did the time before, right? So we've got the talking head's color histogram. And then we get some other picture. And then we get the talking head's color histogram. And then we get a picture unlike the first one, and then the Talking Heads color histogram. And then one unlike the first one, and then the Talking Head. And then one unlike, you know, you get the idea, right? So we've got this sequence that keeps coming back to the same color histogram. So you can look at that and you can say, news program. All right? Got somebody in the studio, they keep cutting out, going other places, come back. And not only news program, I know which ones are the stories. So I can't tell where the stories begin and end, because, you know, I'm on the Talking Head and they're wrapping up the previous story and then they start the next story, and I can't tell that from just the picture. But I can tell that from the words they use, because they shift their vocabulary every time they shift stories. But I can at least tell when they're going off to do something else. And then if I want to have a picture of the anchor, it's really easy to figure out which one's the anchor. Do the same thing with a football game. What do you get? Wide shot, narrow shot. Wide shot, narrow shot. Wide shot, narrow shot. Football game. Right? Do it with a baseball game. What do you get? Narrow shot, moving shot. Right? Narrow shot, moving shot, wide shot. So there are patterns that occur in all of this. One time in speech, I was like, I wonder if you could do the same thing with who's talking. So if you get somebody talking for an hour, and then somebody else talking, then the first person. Somebody else talking, then the first person. Somebody else talking, then the first person. What's that?
That's an interview.
Well, that's a lecture. Oh. They talk for an hour. But if they do that all the way through, then it's an interview. The person who talks the longest, are they the interviewer or the interviewee?
Well, do you mean that? Do you mean collective longest or individual longest?
Yeah, so individually, you'd expect the interviewer to be longer at the beginning, right? Introduces the person, and then the interviewee to be longer answering questions, perhaps.
So you know, just saying yes, no, then.
It doesn't make for a very good program. But you can visually see these if you plot out who's talking when. So all of these sort of structural decompositions depend upon the ability to be able to recognize that this person at this time is the same as this person at that time, right? Or this image at this time is the same as this image at that time. So there's this whole category in speech. And in video of structural characterization. And you can use it for two things. One is you can use it for program type determination, and the other thing you can use it for is to then zoom in on the parts you want. For example, in an interview, you probably don't want to start replay on the answer. You probably want to start replay on the question, right? If there's something that the system's taking you in. So knowing the structure can be helpful. So here's the real trick. All the things that we can do with video retrieval work pretty poorly. Face recognition is not terribly accurate. Video OCR makes mistakes because they put up on the screen somebody's name, but part of the name is in front of the podium and part of the name is in front of them. You know, and they're wearing a black sweater that day, so, you know, the few characters don't get recognized correctly. Right, so video OCR is a really hard problem. All this shot stuff is easy to screw up.
And so what about the moving tickers you see in a lot of news programs now? Does that cause issues? Or can you kind of block that out?
Yeah, so most of this work was done before the moving tickers became common. They're very easy to detect.
Right.
Right, I mean, they're always in the same region, and they're moving in a very easily modeled way. It actually helps if you have, if you're trying to do video OCR, if you can take the image on the screen and integrate it over multiple frames, because then if the person moves a little bit, you get a better shot at it. And the same thing would happen with the tickers. If you wanted to do OCR, you'd simply re-register all frames and try to read that character as the character moved across the screen. You get more shots at it, and hence an apparently higher resolution.
I've heard that stickers like a video track which is added on the video means they can be separated.
So there are closed captions and open captions, right? And closed captions are coded digitally as characters and then drawn on the screen. They don't typically move across the screen. They just, they're you know, like subtitles in films, right? So you'll often see this for Spanish language here in the United States. So those are closed captions, and they're very easily processed. You get a device that puts out time-coded ASCII, and then you can associate what's being said with what is being what's being written, what's being said with what's being said. The open captions, the on-screen captions, are the hard ones, and all of the stuff that's tickering by on the screen is an open caption. Television sets don't have that stuff, is it? So they're actually drawing
the news.
Yeah, the little thing moving across that says, you know, stock market's down, stock market's up, stock market's down. That's all happening in the video channel. And it's pretty low resolution, but it's coming from a very small character set. So it's pretty, you know, you can actually pull it out if you want. Okay, so all this stuff's bad, but you can get many different cuts on something and so have many ways of asking about it. So you might have closed captions, open captions, speech recognition. The closed captions and the speech recognition actually have different things in them. So even though they're trying to transcribe it, what they're doing is there's some little old lady in Helena, Montana, who is sitting here typing as they're listening, and they're typing shorthand. And so you'll see the silliest things will come out. I mean, they're not actually typing all the characters. They're hitting some shorthand buttons that like court reporters do, and you know, all of a sudden it'll say, you know, and on Tuesday, Octoflugeron said, but you know, they hit the Octoflugeron button, off it comes, and there's no way to fix it, because it's happening in real time. So the error rate in closed caption is actually fairly high. It's about 10%. The error rate for speech recognition on news broadcasters is about 10% also, but it's a different 10%. So there you get redundancy. You get two tries at finding out what was actually said. But with things like face recognition, you get a completely different source of information, right? So it's very uncommon for them to cut to somebody and say, you know, when they put up on screen George Bush, to say, "Hi, I'm George Bush." They don't do that, right? But you can get George Bush's face, and you can also get George Bush's voice. So when we do speech recognition, normally what we try to do is we try to build a system that doesn't care who's talking. All it cares is what they said. But really what we did was we took the signal and we split out all the parts that depended on who's talking and threw it away. And just kept the part that captured what they said. Well, you can also take all the part that was talking about who's talking, and you can take just that and say, well, it doesn't look like this person talking, it doesn't look like that person talking. And so, I mean, you find both Nixon and Nixon impersonators, but you'll at least have another attempt at this. So you get both redundant information, face, video OCR, and voice, and complementary information, what they say and who they are, and where they are in this pattern of shot changes. Now, news has been extensively studied. And one of the things people have tried to do is they've tried to break up stories in the news. So if I have a news program, I want to find the beginning and end of each story so that I can retrieve a story for you. How would I know if I changed stories? well, previously people were talking about Iraq. Now people are talking about thunderstorms. Probably change stories, right? So when I change vocabulary, well, that's a good clue, I change stories. So I make a sliding window and I run it along, and I say, at every point of the sliding window, on the left, how similar is it with my BM25 or whatever to on the right? And when that when the difference is maximized, I say, well, there's a possible story about me. Just a standard IR trick, right? Sliding windows, text similarity. Second thing is, it turns out that in between stories in the news, they pause. Okay, we can look for pauses. If they happen to occur at the same spot as vocabulary shifts, we're in business, we got a story boundary change. My favorite one is if it turns out that you're fortunate and you're working with the news hour, they go, and then you get the next story. And you're like, well, that one ought to be really easy, right? Okay. So you can get all sorts of different kinds of cues for story segmentation. Now what we've got to do is we've got to try to figure out how to actually build this into a system. What does the query look like? What does the selection interface look like? So here's an actual system that they built at Carnegie Mellon called Informedia. So this was one of the Digital Library Initiative projects. And what they were trying to do was figure out how to make video libraries. And so they had these educational videos. Was one of their applications. They did a lot of stuff with news. This is available now as a commercial product from Garage, which in fact our library here has. So, you know, you could type in your query and it would go matching words and do what it could. And it would pick these key frames that had been selected based on the motion analysis. Right. And then you can hit play. And it would play you a little transcript, and there'd be a little, remember when you guys were kids, did they have Follow the Bouncing Ball? So you were supposed to sing along with Mitch or whatever? Well, you didn't sing along with Mitch, but anyway, so you can do a Follow the Bouncing Ball, where you know which word is being done at which time, because you build a speech recognition system, and it doesn't really know what the words are, but it knows the word, you know, they said a word more like animals than like Darwin. And you know what order they set it in, so it's pretty easy to get the Follow the Bouncing Ball to be in roughly the right spot. And so there you're taking advantage of the fact that speech is very hard to make a summary, but the video is a beautiful summary. So we use the video when we need to go there. So this is my favorite. This is a video of somebody jumping off a diving board. And I want to make a summary of this. I want to show you what this video of. And so you make a simulated time-lapse photography showing the action. So you don't just see one key frame, but you see the evolution over time. It's kind of like tigers. It really doesn't work with anything other than jumping off a high dive. But it works really well, right? So it gives you an idea of the sorts of things you can do with it. Okay. You can find lots of things on this is actually work that was done at the University of Maryland, that was asking the question, should I show you a storyboard? So now you've got a small number of pixels allocated to each of several keyframes, or should I show you a slideshow in which you see the keyframe maybe larger and then you see one after another? Which one would allow you to get a better feel for what was going on? And it turns out, probably not surprisingly, but the storyboard gives you the better feel for the dynamic evolution than the slideshow does. Unless you play the slideshow fairly slowly. But if you get the slideshow going, you know, as quickly as you can sort of see what's happening here. You know, they took off, they went to the moon, they came back, right? They're old. Right? You can pick that up faster from the storyboard. And so you see lots of systems now that have the storyboard. Okay, shall we take a break? And when we come back, we'll back up and do the speech music, the end of that, and then we'll have some time to talk about project presentations and the like.
Yeah.
just by next week. Oh, by next week?
Right.
All the stuff that will.
I was saying tomorrow. We met up on Saturday and did the
MSN
thing and got the results and wrote it up. And now, I think it's red, like,
and I'll have turned it into what Skype
is. I guess they need some other people. We met on Saturday and Friday night.
So, set up a date in front of me for each other.
I'm going to
cold out there.
So this was an attempt early on at figuring out whether who was talking when would give you a way of recognizing things like this. So we did yellow for people we were looking for, blue for boys, red for girls, to see if you could just see, you know, something visually. It turned out we did a user study with this, and what we found out was everybody said, well, yeah, but I'd rather have a little icon that said interview. We're like, oh, well, if it's that easy to recognize, it wouldn't be hard to build a classifier. And so we stopped trying to do that. So it was doing as usual, it will catch up in 15 minutes. Okay, so seriously, you get your pick on where to start. We were talking about the Bullock project, yes, and we got into the teachers, things like that. Okay. Yep. For video editing, yes.
Creating all that analysis, making it into documents, and then.
You mean like the face recognition stuff, or which sorts of things?
And like, for example, yeah, the face recognition stuff, or even the interviewer, they can say, for example, we have this person who's the interviewer, and this person who's the interviewee, and they're talking about this thing, for example, and putting all of that stuff into one document, and then indicating.
I mean, not perfectly, but that's what they try to do. Okay, so did we get this far? Okay, so did we get to the technology? Did you see this yet?
Yes.
We're done? Easy. This is about where we stopped, right? Did we get there?
No.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is a batch evaluation. Those are the documents. There's a topic. So we took the query from the title field. This is a standard pair format, so it is, title is what you would say to a web search engine when you're searching, so it's like three words or less, not a lot of stop words. Okay, so it's four words, it's got a stop word, but usually, description is a single sentence, and a narrative is what you would say, is what a librarian would understand after a reference interview. It's the basis for relevance judgment. The relevance judgments that we did were five type judgments. So we said, if the query was food in Auschwitz, and you knew, you had somebody who knew that food was sometimes withheld in Auschwitz, then it was relevant, no question about it. But you might also be able to draw some inferences. So you might have seen undernourished people in Auschwitz. From this you could infer something about food in Auschwitz. Right? So you could have direct or indirect relevance, and so we took either of those. Now the direct relevance could be really on point, or it could be sort of weakly related. The indirect could call for a lot of inference, or only a little. And so we had five levels here. So we had the numbers 0 through 4, and we took 2, 3, and 4, direct and indirect, and we treated that as if it were relevant. Now, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to say, tell us which of these it is, direct or indirect, tell us which level it is, and then we're going to just map it down to a single binary value. Why not ask the assessor to just give us a binary value in the first place? You all just got done doing batch evaluations, right?
Would it yield more consistent evaluations?
Good question.
Fatigued among the evaluator?
This would make them more fatigued?
No, making them pick a number is...
Zero or one is harder? We made them do 1 through 5 on 5 different scales. Those are 2 of them. That seems more fatiguing.
More fatiguing, but they're forced to sort of pay attention to what they're doing a little bit more. Yeah. So as they start to get bored...
So they can't just do just
yes,
say no?
Yes, no.
Yeah.
They kind of have to stay focused on the task.
Okay. So it certainly did engage them in the task. There's no question about that. One of the reasons why we thought this would be interesting is because people are more consistent when you give them a middle choice. Right? So if I give you an even number of choices, I say, is it relevant or not? Right? Or is it, you know, really relevant, a lot relevant, just a little relevant, or not at all relevant? Having to decide what to do with something that's right in the middle, people will half the time bump it up and the other half the time bump it down, and they're adding inconsistency to themselves. But if you give them the middle category, and then you always treat the middle category as if it's yes, they'll become much more consistent. Yeah? So we need binary relevance for the computation of things like mean average precision, but we pick up some inter-annotator agreement by giving 3-state or 5-state relevance. Now that's not really why we did it. The reason why we did it is because what we wanted to do was we wanted to see whether it made a difference whether it was direct or indirect, or if it was these other kinds of relevance. So we got things like, you might ask about food in Auschwitz, and what I know is about the food situation in some other camp. You know, there are a lot of people who are interested in food in Auschwitz that would be interested in that, but that's not what they asked about, so it's not relevant. That doesn't mean it's not useful, it's just not on topic here. And so maybe systems would make a mistake and give you lots of things like this and be penalized for it, even though people would find it useful. So this gave you a lot more flexibility in what you would evaluate. We had 2 problems when we did this. Well, we had 1 serious problem. We're trying to measure how well speech recognition systems could be used to search. But somebody was going to take the speech recognition technology and improve it years later, thus making all of the test collection development we had done no longer applicable. If we only took the results of automated search systems and scored them, because now new things would be found if better speech recognition came along. So what we decided to do was, instead of having people search the audio using the best technology we had, what we did was we had them search the metadata that had been previously assigned by people. And therefore, no matter what changes were made in the audio, processing abilities later, the relevance judgments would be independent of the speech recognition technology. So now, then you could change the speech recognition technology and use the same relevance judgments. To do this, we hired a set of relevance assessors. I do know we talked about this last time. That were librarians and historians. And then over time, the librarians, when they left the project, were replaced by more historians, having trained the first group of historians. The subsequent historians, the historians knew the domain, but they didn't know about searching. And the librarians knew about searching, but they didn't know the domain. And so ultimately what you wanted was people who knew both. And it's easier to teach historians to search in terms of that than it is to teach librarians on the other side. We then also did the usual Trek-style pooled relevance assessment, where we had several different systems doing search, we took their highly ranked documents, we removed the ones that had already been assessed in the search guided process, and we assessed the remainder. Here's what happened when we did a limited amount of inter-annotator agreement study. In addition to the five different categories, we also asked people to give us overall relevance. But we didn't define for them what overall relevance meant. We just said, well, whatever you think, based on whatever you've discovered, whether this is topically relevant or not. What we found was that we got Kappa scores. Have we talked about where these come from yet? No? Okay. So this is actually quite useful if you're thinking about patch evaluation today. Let's say that we look at the same document, right? This one. Okay. Look relevant to you?
Sure.
Not to me. Yep, I agree. So you see how that works, right? We're going to make independent judgments, and we'll have then a set of zeros and ones, right? You got your set of zeros and ones, you got my set of zeros and ones, and then if we always agree, then we'll say, fine, we always agree. If we always disagree, then I'm awfully disagreeable, yes? Because remember, we're going to do this independently. But let's say how often did we agree? Most of the time, right? So we agree that most things are not relevant. But most things are not relevant, and you can get any two people to agree on any question that most things are not relevant. So I can't go telling you, oh gosh, we agree 99.2% of the time. The question is, did we agree on what was relevant? And the answer is never. Right? So what we want to do is we want to say, well, look, how many of the things, in my opinion, were not relevant? Okay, so I don't know whatever that number is. 80%, 90% of the things are not relevant. So if 90% of the things are not relevant, and we're just randomly picking, what's the chance we both have picked not relevant? Very high. It doesn't tell you anything. Just chance would tell you that we would agree on the not relevant. But if only 1 out of 10 there is relevant, and we happen to agree on it, that you should get big points for that. So this is chance-corrected agreement. And the highest possible chance-corrected agreement is 1. We agree on everything. And the lowest possible chance-corrected agreement isn't 0, it's -1. We disagree on everything, right? And 0, because it's chance-corrected, is we agree at the level chance would predict, okay? And this statistic is called kappa. And the way that you find it out is you do exactly that study. You give two people the same task independently, and you see what answers you get back. So when we do that, we found, so remember, 1 is perfect and 0 is random, and negative is positive, right? And we found that we got between, on direct relevance, between 0.3 and 0.7 with an average of 0.5. So this says that we're doing way better than chance on agreement, but that we have a substantial amount of disagreement, right? Okay. Now look what's going on indirect. We have between negative a little bit and 0.5 with an average below 0.1. So you would say here, we agree on direct and we don't agree on indirect. So you look at this and you would then have an interview with the assessor and you would say, tell me, how did you assess indirect? And they tell you, and you go to the other assessor and have, tell me, how did you assess indirect? And what you find was we had a training problem. And we weren't standardizing the way people were interpreting indirect. So we knew what indirect meant. they knew what indirect meant. They just didn't know the same thing we knew, right? It meant something to them. Each assessor has made up their own meaning for indirect, right? And so we learned from this that we needed to do better training. Okay? Yeah?
You said that indirect can be where things are, people are taking inferences on things too.
That's what we meant.
That's what you meant?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because inferences are pretty hard for a lot of people to get anyway. I mean, and they can be interpreted differently by different people anyway, regardless of what training you give them.
Yes, and in fact,
especially when language is factored in, I mean, depending on whether or not this is done in a language that is their first language.
Yes, and I believe we were in everyone's first language in this case, but we never went back and measured again the effect of the training. We just went back in, found that there was actually a disagreement in the understanding of indirect, did the training, and went on. So we should have gone back and measured it, because it could still be low, because of the difficulty of getting indirect. We actually have the data for this now. You can also see that people couldn't agree on context and comparison. One of the reasons why this was happening was what people were searching for was things that are directly relevant, and then they happened to annotate things that were indirect. So there are really three cases here. There's a case where they found it and called it indirect. There's the case where they found it and called it not indirect. And then there's the case where they didn't find it. Right. And we had to remove all of those. So these are only the cases where it was found in common, which are a relatively small number because they weren't the search focus. These are the relevance judgments that we got. So the way you read these plots is topic number 2361 here has got a whole lot of non-relevant judgments, and then it's got a small number of relevant judgments. Now, if this number of relevant judgments gets too small, then we can't tell the systems apart. So let's say, for example, that the number of known relevant documents is zero, just to take an extreme case. Then every system must get zero as their, or one, depending on how you compute it. They find none of the zero relevant documents. They all find the same number. You can't tell the systems apart. So every time we get zero, we remove the topic. But what if I get one? What if there's one relevant document in existence to be found? How will this hurt me if I use that topic? What's the mean average precision? I'm sorry, what's the average precision for one relevant document? Think about this. That one relevant document, it must be in position one, or position two, or position three, or some position, right? It's got to be someplace in the list. Position 4 billion, right? So if it's in position one, what's the precision?
100%.
100%. If it's in position two, what's the precision? 50%. Position three? So I can never get 75%. Right, so what I'm doing is I'm putting a lot of noise in. I'm measuring because now if I had 10 relevant documents, then the first relevant document I get would be at 10% or would be at 100% or 50%. But then the second one might be 2/3 and the 2/3 would be average. And so I can get lots of different values for average precision if I have lots of relevant documents. But if I have only one relevant document, I get what's called quantization noise. The score must be either this score or that score or that score. It can't be any score in between. Right? So I'm losing my ability to measure because my evaluation measure has got a quantization to it that's too far apart. Yes? Okay, so I don't want only a single relevant document. In fact, you'll see here, there's a topic with only a single relevant document, topic 1668, and we just removed it. Any topic with fewer than five. In fact, we removed all of these, and you can see why we removed these, right? But why did we remove this one? I mean, this doesn't have that problem, right? here is, about half the documents we know are not relevant, and about half the documents we know are relevant. So this is the opposite problem. Every time we turn around, I found another relevant document. What do you bet if I assess one more document, it might have been relevant? No. Look at this. Over here. This is one we use. If I assess one more document, what's your guess? Probably not relevant, right? If I assess one more document, what's your guess?
50-50.
Yeah? So here we probably found most of the relevant documents, because I've got all these non-relevant things that I thought were worth looking at, but turned out not to be relevant. So I'm working real hard, I'm not finding many relevant documents. I can probably stop, I found most of them. Over here, I haven't found most of them yet. So we don't want too many, and we don't want too few. It's like Goldilocks. Just the right number. Yes? This is bothering you.
Well, no, I agree, but I guess I'm wondering, because the problem I don't have a search engine by Google now, it's supposed to be so great, but there's too many relevant documents.
Yes.
And so you have permission overload, and at the end of the day, it's like, you just use top five, but you don't feel comfortable because you haven't seen them all, and you don't know which ones are the best. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want too many relevant documents. So I guess the problem is how you solve the problem. The question is how you solve the problem and why does Google keep it like that?
Okay, so this is a different problem than the problem we were trying to work on here, but it's a really good question.
That's related.
Yeah, yeah. When we were first building search engines, the collections we could search were very small, 1,000 abstracts, back in the early days. And what we found was very small collections are very easy to search. Because you have to have a few relevant documents, otherwise you couldn't find anything. But once you have a few relevant documents, a high percentage of your documents are relevant. So it's a pretty easy problem, right? It's a target-rich environment. Then as the collection gets bigger, search gets harder. Mean average precision numbers go down as the collection gets larger. If the collection gets large enough, ultimately what happens is that the mean average precision numbers start going up. And you're looking at this and you're like, things don't usually behave that way. Once you get going in a direction, things usually keep going that way, or then maybe they level off. But what's happened is, in a small collection, people only express the idea one way, or two ways, or three ways. But gosh, on the web, every way of saying your idea is expressed someplace, and if the web gets bigger, it's expressed over and over and over again that way. So you're surely not finding everything. I mean, recall is pretty low. But you're not really in a high recall search environment. You're not trying to find everybody who's ever said anything about this. You're trying to find some answers to your questions. So if you're a precision-oriented searcher, once the collection gets large enough, it's really easy to find what you're looking for, because I saw a statistic the other day. If I pick a word to describe something, and you pick a word to describe something, what's the chance we'll pick the same word? It's about 20%, right? If we just point at something, I don't know, that. Yeah, what would you call that? One word.
Whiteboard.
I call it a board, you call it a
white. Because it was not the whiteboard.
One word. One word, yeah. So, in any case, just across all the things we could pick, we'd have about a 20% chance of agreeing. But once I have a lot of people discussing something, it gets really easy to find people that are using my word. Because people are using all of them. So it's a natural problem. I don't have a solution for it, but that's what's causing the problem.
Right, because I guess you can't eliminate stuff that's relevant just because there's too many things.
I mean, if its job is to find you things, it's your job to figure out how to use it. But it's finding them. Where was I going with this, though?
Goldilocks.
Ah, Goldilocks. So Goldilocks turns out to be a real problem. You see what happens? If I don't have enough relevant documents, I get quantization noise. If I have no relevant documents, I can't tell systems apart. Yeah? If I have too many relevant documents, then my my mean average precision number is not very good because my assumption that I found most of the relevant documents is no longer accurate. So I can, with these batch evaluations, I can only evaluate things that are Goldilocks topics. I can't evaluate all the other topics. And yet, when I build systems for people to use, they do search for things that aren't in the collection. And how the system behaves is important to them. But because all we're trying to do is compare two systems, and we're not comparing user reactions, we're just comparing the rank list, the rank lists are indistinguishably different. If there are no relevant documents, all systems are equal. Right? And so it's important to understand that we are exploring, by design, only a small fraction of the topic space. And then we're extrapolating and saying, well, I sure hope you like this system when it's got too many relevant things, because I can't measure how well it's doing that. Or when it has not enough relevant things, because I can't measure that either, but let's hope you like it. And so that what that means is, you need to look at these things in user studies, right? Okay. Okay, so we invited seven of our friends to come together from Ottawa, West Bohemia in the Czech Republic, Dublin, Twente in the Netherlands, Alicante in Spain, Madrid in Spain, and ourselves. And we tried, everybody got 5 tries, to see how good a score you could get. And here were the results in 2006. So it turned out that if you were in Dublin, you did statistically significantly better than if you were in either Ottawa or Maryland. And if you were anyplace else, you did statistically significantly worse than these folks. So have we talked about statistically significantly yet? So what happens is, on a particular topic, you might do better or worse, but what we're looking for is the pattern of doing better or worse using tests like a sign test or a t-test or a paired Wilcox sign rank test. And so, I mean, here you can see that the means aren't even visually different. Here they're slightly different, but they're statistically indistinguishable. Okay, now, there's really one little problem here, otherwise this would all be very impressive, and that is that you can see that this is mean average precision, and mean average precision goes from 0 to 1, except here, where it's going to 0.1. So this says that we're like less than 1/10 of the maximum possible score. We're doing what you might call terrible. Okay. Now, here's another way to look at it. So these are from a different year. This is from 2005. The score is a little bit higher that year. You can see we're above 10%, but not quite at 15%. But these are mean average precision, so they're averaged over all the relevant documents. If you just cut it off at 10 and say, how are we doing at 10? This is, we're doing about a quarter, that's what these numbers are, precision at 10. We've got about a quarter of the segments that we're showing you are relevant. That's not too bad. I mean, there are 4 minutes in a segment. And if a quarter of the ones I'm showing you are relevant, then to find the first relevant segment, you've got to listen to 16 minutes of play. That's better than it was before when you had to listen to 116,000 hours of audio. But it's not, we're not getting overwhelmed by Google. On the other hand, if you look at this, this is what happens if you search the metadata. And this is a pretty stupid search of the metadata. We're just taking the query words and matching them in the metadata. Right? And here we're at 0.5. So we're doing twice as well here as we are here. But these are averages. So we might be doing better here on some topic than we are here. Right? Turn that one off. So here, these blue bars are how well we're doing if we're searching speech recognition. And these red bars are how well we're doing if we're searching metadata. And when the red bar is stacked on top of the blue bar, it's how much better we're doing when we're searching metadata. Okay? So we never do better with speech recognition than we do with metadata. We never have blue on top of red. Now, if you notice what's going on here, anything between topic 1188 and topic 1187, these aren't in numerical order, but rather in how hard they are ordered, you may as well stay home. Right? Speech recognition got nothing at all. Speech recognition got just a little bit all the way over to here. So the big lesson you learn out of this is, if you're going to use speech recognition, search for topic 1179. Right? Because that one will work well for you. So now the question is, what is topic 1179?
Tigers.
What's that?
Tigers.
Yeah, it's kind of a Holocaust equivalent of tigers. Okay. Sorry, I don't have it on the slide. But I do have all these hard ones. So what is it that's easy about those? Doesn't really matter. It's easy. It's a solved problem. The question is, how do I make these better? So this is where people often don't go all the way when they do a batch evaluation. They do a batch evaluation and they say, who mean average precision of 0.32? Okay, we're done. That's like, okay, what does that tell you about what you need to do to your system? Right? So here we've taken that previous plot, laid it on its side, and then looked at it. So here's query number 11, topic number 1178. It's Volkswagen Jews. So it turns out that we get the word Volkswagen appears in the metadata, but it never appears in the speech recognition. Jews appears in the speech recognition and in the metadata, and so when we're doing speech recognition, it's as if we did a search on Jews, which is probably not a good search in a Holocaust collection, particularly when we stem it, and it matches all sorts of random stuff. This one's witness to Eichmann. Eichmann doesn't show up in the speech recognition. It shows up in the metadata. Witness gets them to wit. It matches everything that stems to wit, and that's Eichmann. Right? Sinti Roma Holocaust. We get Holocaust, but we miss Sinti Roma. You see what's going on here? So these are the words that are not being correctly recognized, but the speech recognition system knows them. So you know, speech recognition systems can't guess words it's never heard before. It has to be in the lexicon. It's not like OCR that way. It guesses entire words at a time. But these words it knows and never guesses. This word here it doesn't know, so it has an excuse. But these words here are in the lexicon and never guessed. What is common among those words? What's the characteristic that's causing them to be missed?
They're not in English.
They're not in English. Yeah, okay. I'll go for that. What else? They might be, Volkswagen might be mispronounced. For the longest time, when I gave talks, I was saying, Ig Farben, Farben, and so somebody told me, Ig Farben, the name of the company. So pronunciation could indeed be a problem.
It would not appear in the training data for speech recognition.
That turns out to be the key. Why don't we get these? We don't get these because they don't appear in the Wall Street Journal. Volkswagen being an exception, for which I have no excuse. But the rest of them are not often written about in the Wall Street Journal. So remember how the speech recognition system works. It takes the sounds, and it takes all the words it knows, and it tries to tile the word onto the sounds And if it can, that becomes a possible word in that position. It takes all the possible words in all the positions, and then it says, which of these look like the stuff I've seen in the Wall Street Journal? Right? Because it's built a language model, a N-word language model, maybe a four-word language model, off of the Wall Street Journal. It said, does this look like sequences of words that I see in the Wall Street Journal? And the answer is, well, yeah, when they're talking about ordinary stuff, sure, but when they start talking about this stuff, no. Never see those words in the Wall Street Journal. Okay. A couple of important lessons here. One lesson, which should be obvious at this point, is that there's an entire class of systems that we've spent, gosh, the whole second half of the semester talking about, in which the system learns from examples. Okay? You show the system representative examples, and it learns how to do something. It learns to translate, it learns to do speech recognition, it learns to do OCR. Yes? But did you notice the word that I snuck in on you?
Representative.
If I have examples that aren't representative, the system learns to do the wrong thing. Yes? All of these systems are brittle. They're designed to do what they do. So an OCR system can recognize characters that are written in a way it's seen before. You show it a font it's never seen before, it doesn't know what to do. Right? A speech recognition system can recognize words that it's seen used before, but you show it words it hasn't seen used before, even if you tell it about the word, you tell it how it's pronounced. It's never seen it used, it doesn't know what to do. A translation system may not be able to translate, for example, people's names, because it's never seen this person's name translated. How would it know how to translate this person's name? So these systems that are learning systems are all handicapped by a need to have representative training data. And we are just now ending the period of intense research interest here, where the trick has been, how high a score can I get at TREC? Or how high a score can I get in, you know, NT evaluation or ASR evaluation? And we're entering the period of how much money can I make? How can I get Google to buy this thing from me? Right? And for that, the question is, how well does it work for the queries people ask? So, here's the second thing that we did. We ran this same study with a better speech recognition system in 2006. Not a little bit better. This system had a 35% word error rate. We replaced it with a system that had a 25% word error rate. So instead of getting one word wrong out of every three, it's only getting one word wrong now out of every four. It's a substantially better system. It didn't get a single one of those words right. Every word it missed before, it missed again. Now, it got better at something. So we went to look at what it got better at. It got better at the. It. Of. Any. Okay, so measuring the word error rate isn't necessarily the right thing to do. Now, I think I showed you an example back here. Yeah. Do you remember reading this? This is a speech recognition that it was using in 2004. So it says, December, when you talk about what your daily life was like, well, after realized, I was a little girl going to public school, so there's no punctuation in here. During the day after works, there were all the lessons and activities in the winter. That's the system that gets one word wrong out of every three. Here's the system that's better. It's one word wrong out of every four. December, when you talk about what your daily life was like, well, after, you see what's going on there? They're identical. Why are they the same? Yeah, you can't get any better. So the errors that are made, I mean, if it's one word wrong out of every four, that's averaged over the entire collection. But what do we make errors on? We make errors on people that are hard to recognize. Right? We don't make errors by word. It's not like, well, we got that word right. God, let's hope we get the next one right. I mean, if we get that word right, we got a good chance of getting the next one right. We get some people completely right, and we get other people completely wrong. And when we make a little bit better system, we get better at one of the other people. So the measures that have been used to measure how well a component works don't necessarily tell you how well that component does its part of some job you have in mind. Because the errors here are made at the scale of interviews, but they're being measured at the scale of work. So this is important if you're going to work with the output of any of these systems. This is kind of an interesting plot here. What it shows you is whether we found a relevant document. So this is just the relevant documents now. By using the search guided assessment, so this is the one searching the metadata manually, by doing the highly ranked assessment, or both, right? We would have found it either way. And what this tells you is that the majority of the big differences are coming from the search guide. So you'd look at this and you'd say, boy, if I didn't have that search guided on those four topics, and maybe a few of these others in here, I'd be a little worried. But if I didn't have the highly ranked, this pooled relevance assessment, I don't think I'd worry quite so much. Right? Just in numbers. But that doesn't tell you how much it really affects the score. So here's the kind of plot that we use to see what the real effect is. So this is a plot that shows you all the relevant documents, so search guided and highly ranked, being used to compute the mean average precision of every system that competed in 2005. Right? So we just took a system that competed in 2005, and if it worked on the metadata, and it got a score of 0.32, we plotted at 0.32 someplace on this line. And then we hid from ourselves the highly ranked. We said, well, let's pretend we didn't know what the highly ranked was. And then, so we plotted its score using only the search guide. Now, if the score didn't change, we would have gotten a line that went up with slope 1. And every point would have been on the line. If the score got cut in half, it would still be useful for comparing systems. The slope would just be lower. Yes? As long as the line's straight, it doesn't matter if we hide these things. You could do this with anything. You could hide all the odd-numbered ones and see what happens. Right? So what happens when you hide the other ones? So now we'll put highly ranked back and take away search guide. Now that crowd doesn't quite go crazy, but it start bouncing around a little bit. So this is still really good. But this is only really good as long as the systems are using similar technology. If we change the speech recognition technology, this could get quite a bit worse. Whereas this one can't get worse from that effect. So from this, we decided that we could get away with doing just search guided relevance. So we're measuring the measurement system. this is a really interesting plot. It's a little hard to read, but the line to look at is this one. In about 2 years from the beginning of our work in Czech until we got the first really good system, it took 2 years, and we got to a word error rate of one word wrong out of every three, 35%. In English, it took us 2 years to get to a word error rate of one word wrong out of every three, 35%. So you're saying to yourself, well, it's only two samples, but in Czech and in English, we made about the same, it took about the same amount of time to get to about the same level of performance. Okay? Except that in Czech, we only transcribed 86 hours. And in English, we transcribed 200 hours. So we worked really much, much harder in English. We spent 10 times as much money to build the English system as we did the Czech system. And yet, Czech was so much easier. Right? One-tenth the investment to get the same level of performance. Why?
For a lot of the English speakers, boring, in fact.
Yes. And so were the Czech speakers. They all had Czech accents.
They were speaking
consistently.
Right.
Representative. Trying to get it. Yep. So look what happened in Russian. So in Russian, we made the same investment. This is 100 hours of training data. And we're 45%. And you could imagine if you had 200 hours of training data, you might have been up to 35%. So imperial languages are difficult because they have high variability. They're spoken in many places in many ways. Regional languages are easy because they're spoken in the way that they're spoken. That's like representative training. We had a little problem in Czech. So here's what happened. In English, they put down these boundaries on the documents, on the segments. We treated them like documents. They were 4 minutes long on average. And they were where topic shifts occurred. And they did this for 10,000 hours of English, 4,000 interviews. And the cost of doing that was $8 million. And most of the cost was in finding the beginning and the end. And so they said to themselves, how about we do this? How about we just play the tape? And if we hear something mentioned for which we have a term in our thesaurus, we'll lift the term out of the bucket and paste it on the timeline at that point. No more written summaries. We've been calling this metadata, but it includes a handwritten summary. No more written summaries because there's something to summarize. There's no more boundaries. Where topics shift, you'd have to find them automatically. So now we want to build an IR test collection, but we have no documents. We just have entire interviews. Now, you would say to yourself, it's an interesting research question whether we can do something with these thesaurus terms that have been pasted on your manual. While we tried to answer the question, how useful is this? They spent another $8 million and annotated 116,000 hours, minus 10,000, so 106,000 hours, in 32 languages using this technique before we answered the question whether we could use it to find anything. Well, it turned out not. That was the interesting story. So, we had to do two things. One is we couldn't use mean average precision anymore. We have no documents. The second is, we had to build a relevance assessment system for the assessors in which they would tell us what should be found, but there are no documents to find. So what we said to the assessors was, what's the real test? I want to listen to somebody talking about something, right? Okay, then what do I have to tell you? When to start listening. I don't really have to tell you when to stop listening. You can probably figure that out. But if I don't tell you when to start listening, you're out of luck. So what you need my help with is when to start listening. So we will build a system that is supposed to guess when to start listening, and you, the relevance assessor, you'll tell us when we're supposed to start listening by somehow finding the place we're supposed to start listening. And then we have to design an evaluation measure that's based on just start times. So here's the system we built. These are the thesaurus terms. This is the speech recognition. One of the things you'll notice, the thesaurus terms are in English. That's what thesaurus was in English. The speech recognition is in Czech. That's the people we're speaking Czech. So you had to be bilingual to be a relevance assessor. People could search in here or in here. The system, when we did highly ranked assessments, would just search in here. We were able to find, with search guided, most of what needed to be found. These two cases were cases where search guided essentially failed and highly ranked found a lot that search guided didn't miss. Remember, there'd been none of this in English. We used this to do triage on the, this is the number of positive judgments done in an hour. So this person could do an average of one positive judgment an hour. And this person over here was doing 13 positive judgments an hour. Now you gotta listen to a little something here to know if it's positive, because the speech recognition is pretty bad. And this person wasn't listening very much. So you could go over here and say, my nervousness level starts going up right around here. You know, that I'm not too sure about all these. Let's just use those. This is the duration of the passages. So this is grouped by assessors. So here's one assessor. They made passages that were on average about 2 minutes long, 120 seconds. There's another assessor, about 120 seconds, a little less. Here's another assessor, about 60 seconds. Here's a 120 second assessor. Here's a 120 second assessor. Here's a 4 minute assessor. Somebody was not paying attention during training, right? There's something different in this person's interpretation than in all these other folks, right? So you use all these things to sort of do triage. And so you remember I was showing you inter-annotator agreement stuff before? These are all sorts of triage measures. Interestingly, in English, this is the distribution of passage duration. There are some very short passages. They're at the end when people are holding up objects. And then the average passage is 4 minutes long. Well, think about this. When we're searching, we're looking for, if I don't tell you what I'm looking for, and I ask you to break things up, and you do it for 10,000 hours of audio, on average, you will break it up into 4 minute pieces in this collection. But if I tell you what I'm looking for, then, unless you're the unusual assessor, you will break it up into 1 or 2 minute pieces. So people are more focused in their passage size if we tell them the question than if we don't. This happened to work. Here's our evaluation measure. So what we want is we want to have the start time be what the assessor said it should be. But if the system guesses over here, we'll give it 90% credit. If it guesses over here, 80%. If it guesses perfectly on, 100%. And then we'll compute a scaled version of average precision, which we call generalized average precision. Here, we're way off, so we only get 0.1 credit. Here, we're off by a little bit, so we get 0.4. Here, 0.3. So we drew these pictures. We said, oh, that looks like a good shape. that looks like a good distance. This is 150 seconds from there to there. Right, 2.5 minutes. You're off by 2.5 minutes, we figure you're off by forever. And then we measure how well people do by this measure. This is the group in West Bohemia, which are the only people that actually knew Czech. So they said, well, let's pretend we're from someplace else. We'll just use the words, right? And so this is the generalized average precision measure, which is getting values similar to the mean average precision measure we were seeing in the English fraction. Then, if we do stemming, usually in English, if you do stemming, you get a little bit of a gain. Here in Czech, if you do stemming, it doubles. Because Czech is a highly inflected language. So if you don't account for that in the search system, then you only find people who not only use the word you meant, but use it in the same way. Take a quick five minute break. When we come back, I'll tell you one thing about music retrieval and two things about next week. Or vice versa.
Did you look at any of the videos or go for you?
No, I'm not adding more.
That part is also sorry because you sent the last working.
I mean, the web page, you know, the web page can actually.
Oh,
that is actually the page there.
Yeah,
well,
I tried to start I can add the email ID, everybody, but everybody doesn't have his own level somewhere.
We can have two apart from that, you can just
keep on giving more of it. The best thing is to add, like, for the name, a button next to you, your Google account. Because I think Google is so amazing.
There's quite a lot that's been done on music retrieval. There's an entire conference on music retrieval. But here's one example of how something you already know will work. So let's say that I'm trying to do three blind mice, right? Three blind mice. See how they run. So if I have a query for that, how would it go? And then you're supposed to find me three blind mice, right? So the problem is, I'm always humming off key. So it wouldn't be any good to say, well, what did you hum? And here, I'll find you things like it. What I want to find you is I want to find you things that have the up-down pattern of three blind mice. So if I have down, down, up, down, down, up, down, repeat, down, up, down, repeat. Anyway, you get the idea. So if my singing produces something similar to that, guess what? I can just do the usual make vectors out of this stuff and match it, right? It's the now I have what I have to allow for is I have to allow for insertions and deletions and substitutions. So now I want an edit distance measure instead of a cosine similarity measure, because now position makes a difference. All right. All there is to it. Now you know music, or you're good. So, next is like ESP. We run out of things to do. We'll do ESP recovery. Oh, it's frozen again. If it ever catches up, for a very long time, we were an oral society, right? We had an oral tradition. And then, a very short time ago, what, 5,000 years ago, writing came on the scene. And for this short, little, brief spurt of human history, everything we think of as civilization was developed. Right? That little 5,000-year period in which writing was dominant. But what is it about writing that's so good? Well, it has some degree of permanence. You can find what you wrote. There's some degree of findability. Right? Speech lacks permanence and it lacks findability. Until about 1960, when speech gained permanence with the cheap cassette recorders. So you could go around and interview people and keep cassette tapes. And now speech has achieved a kind of permanence that writing has achieved. In fact, writing has become less permanent, become, you know, ephemeral and digital, and you got to work really hard to keep it around now. But whatever work you do to keep the writing around will keep the speech around. So the only advantage that writing has over speech now is that it's findable. Except we're fixing that findability problem now. And so when writing and speech are both equally permanent and equally findable, writing and speech won't replace writing again. Writing is good for some things. I mean, if you want to sit under a tree and read a book, you don't want the book talking to you, right? But speech is good for other things. I mean, if you listen to some of the Johnson tapes and hear Johnson talking on the telephone, that's a whole lot different than reading a transcript of Johnson talking or reading a textbook about Johnson. Right? So speech is good for some stuff and writing is good for other stuff. And you're going to be living in a world where both will be possible, and it's up to you to design how they'll be used. So in any case, our long human history continues both to be. And it's because of this question that we learn how to search speech. Okay, so enough grand thinking from the large to the small. What happens next week? Not just all of next week, what happens during your 20 minutes next week? Okay. So Mai is going to kick us off. She's going to go first. And to do this, she's going to fly, 10,000 miles away and give her presentation from there. So what we'll do is we'll set up a video conference link, and she'll download her slides and send her demo, and we'll she'll give her talk remotely. And then the remaining teams can go in any order they want. We do have six teams, right? That's good. So the six teams will each have 20 minutes, including questions, and that way we'll use a total of 2 hours for this. We'll keep a half hour for talking about the exam. It never really works out that way, so we'll have 5 minutes for talking about the exam. Okay. There are up here 2 projectors and 2 computers. So you can if you have a web-based system, you can put the system on one and slides on the other and projections separately. Or over here, you can put your computer up and put your slides up over there, just as we did during the demos earlier. So any way you want to do that. If you run over 15 minutes on your presentation, we will all begin to applaud. So that we can save some time for questions and for shifting between the groups. If you have an excruciatingly detailed setup, you want to be the first one after the break. So let me know if you want that particular slide. Okay, so what should you talk about? Well, it would be nice to know what you did, and it would be really nice to know why you did it. So what it is you thought was interesting about this problem. The thing to avoid telling us is how you did it in excruciating detail, because we would be here for a week. I mean, you've been at this for a month. You probably could think of a week's worth of stuff to tell us. Yes? So don't. Just give us an overview. It's really an art form to say something interesting that isn't every last detail. And so I would recommend that you make up this part of your presentation and then delete half the slides. Because there's just you're living inside the beast. There's a tendency to overdo this part. And besides, we can ask you questions. At which point you can say, oh, I have that slide. Right? So don't throw them away, just put them after your last slide. Okay, and then let you know about how well it works, and this would be the batch evaluation and the user study. And again, you could get excruciatingly detailed, but what I would really like you to do is to fill in gaps in our understanding of how to do this that other teams haven't done. So there are some teams here that are working on doing inter-annotator agreement studies. Other teams probably have thought about statistical significance testing. It's not really important that everybody have everything. It is important that somebody have everything, right? So as we go through the class next week, that we hit all the major issues of how do we evaluate. Then it would be really nice if you could end with some thoughts about the things that you learned. Now I'll tell you what everybody says when you do this. It's way harder than we thought it was going to be. Yeah, okay, but everybody else learned that one. So what can you tell us that is something that other people may not have come across, right? So if you learned something in your user study that you thought was really interesting, or if you saw a really interesting kind of result from a detailed analysis of your batch evaluation. Or if the first time you built something, it just simply didn't work because you weren't thinking about it the right way. But you had to build it first to know that. Then what you thought of second is really interesting because you paid a high price for that, right? And nobody else went down that particular path. It's often nice in the user studies, if you're looking for some color, to bring in the voice of the users. Right? So if the user said something, particularly if they said something complimentary, you could bring their voice into this. I would encourage you not to spend your time writing a report different from your presentation. Right? So you can think of your presentation as an outline for your report. And then just grab all those graphs and charts and bullet points and just import the whole of your presentation and write up there into your report and write around it so you won't have to invent that from scratch. Questions?
Can you talk a bit more about the report?
Sure. The website has, y'all aren't going to believe this, actually has a whole week in advance, the description of the report. You'll recognize it. It says, describe the problem, describe the design of your system, don't get too carried away here, you sort of get the idea. As an appendix here, the batch evaluation report goes in. So, I mean, it's not worth changing five words and making it a chapter, you may as well just make it an appendix, right? So that your final report has everything in it. The batch evaluation just got written a bit early. And as an appendix, you can put your presentation slides in it, so you don't have to copy every single detail back out of your presentation slides and make it look like a Word document. Right. You can refer to, the 4 points made in appendix, made in more detail in appendix B is fine. So those two appendices. The things that are not in the same level of detail is that you've got 3 to 4 pages for the design of your system. It's probably a little more detailed than you'll have time for in your talk. And you've got 3 to 4 pages for everything about your user study, because there is no separate user study report, which is probably more detailed than you'll have. Otherwise, pretty much so. Is that a good answer? Other questions?
I'm just wondering if there's any reason not to include also the details of the user study results as an appendix. Or are you expecting
all you can have more appendices.
Are you expecting all of the detail in the body of...
Oh, I don't care. Minimum this. So if you want to have the user study be 3 to 4 pages, 2 of which are in an appendix, if you want to have it be 27 pages, 23 of which are in appendix, I don't care about that either, but I'm not going to read the 23 pages. Well, I mean, I will if you want me to, as a favor, but, if you're like thinking about publishing a book or something. But there's no sense writing that much. The project is not, the project's not about the report. The project's about what you learned by doing. The report's an opportunity to be reflective on what you want. Yeah.
It's a printed document you have to submit or a web page of it?
Web would be fine. Yeah, I don't need a physical document. Okay. Yeah.
This is kind of a basic question. When you say what you learned from the project, can you speak more about the term?
Sure. What did you learn from your project?
I want to know what your identification.
No, what did you learn? What did you learn from your project?
I learned a lot of technical
stuff. Tell me some things you learned.
How to write a code in Java.
That wouldn't be one of them.
That wouldn't be one of them.
Right.
Okay. How to use using to do this stuff.
You're getting closer, but that's not one of them yet.
How listening works.
What's that?
How listening works.
Closer.
How you would apply an application like listening for
information retrieval. Be specific.
Okay.
What did you learn? Specific.
How to use listening to parse XML files to retrieve results.
How
interesting
works.
Okay, so all these things that start with how probably aren't the right answer. Right? That there is a standard package you can use to read XML into Lucene. Right? Learning that, that's something you might use, or somebody else might use that hasn't thought about it. Right? So that's something, that's a thing that you learn. Right? The how, so you learn how to do this, you learn how to do that, that's great. But it's not necessarily what your classmates are going to be interested in. What they can do. What did you learn they want to know? Is that a good answer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not essential that every individual in the class be able to answer that personally. Right? It is essential that every team be able to tell the class what they learned as a team.
The learning for the whole team.
It's what the team has to say in both the presentation and in the the report about what they have learned that people would want to know.
Can we also
useful knowledge?
Yeah. And can we also include the things which we think can be done for this like future research kind of thing? Because we are working on it.
Oh, absolutely. So, so some appropriate way of ending, like suggestions for future research or something like that, just to avoid, you know, saying, okay, let's talk about sport fighting. And if people want to do research papers out of this, that's great. You shouldn't try to do the research paper as your final report because the final report belongs to the team, and the team may have people who don't really want to do a research paper, and that's okay. But then you can go on afterwards. So they'll be happy to work with you on where you could publish a research paper on some aspect of it. And normally, a research paper wouldn't have that kind of scope. A research paper pick a specific research question and answer that specific question. And so, for example, a user study might be the wrong thing to do for a research paper on a certain question. So you wouldn't do it just because you have to in class. That's right? So the difference between what you're trying to learn and what you're trying to do with research. Okay? Yeah?
Do you need a class website if you're not putting the system up on the web?
I would like it if, when you were done, there was a single website for every project that had on it the things that you did. This class, including this, including the presentation, this class has been an experimental reorganization from two standpoints. One is the project's never been done this way before. You guys are going to have to tell me personally or in the evaluations whether this was a good way to do the project. In the past, this class has been dominated by the MLS program. It's been dominated by people who were interested in learning things like how to use and evaluate these systems. The vision that I had when designing the project was that the registration for this class is dominated by the MIM program. And hence, I imagined, a group of people interested in how to create capabilities. And I tried to put together teams that included how to create capabilities and how to see how well they were working. That was the design of the project. So I'm very interested in seeing your reactions to that once you've seen the whole process. And I'm also interested in having examples for future semesters. The other way in which this has been a reorganization is that the presentation order of the topics changed. And in particular, I felt like the beginning of the semester was on too rapid a pace. The middle of the semester was on too slow a pace, and the end of the semester was on too rapid a pace. And that there could have been a better sort of level. I'd be interested in your comments on that. I'd also be interested in your comments on technical level. Because I, you know, sort of etched in my mind is one day where I started drawing matrices on the board, and everybody's like, oh, matrices, finally! And I'm like, okay, we can do more of that. And so this course can be taught at many levels in terms of what you build, and it can be taught at many levels in terms of how we engage with the ideas. Right? Do we spend our time on what it takes to make Lucene work? I do think that's actually something I'd like to get in evaluations, is that it would be helpful to have, as many of the technical classes I teach do, a section that says, here's the main concept, and here's how we do it in Lucene. Here's the main concept, and here's how we do that in Lucene. And so that's sort of where organization can get to. Evaluations this semester are online, and the online evaluation system is having just as much difficulty right now as your projects are. And so we've received a note that said that it will be back sometime, hopefully this semester, but it's not quite back yet. And it has the very highest priority of the people at the university, which has been an awful lot of important things that have lower priorities. But in any case, it will be back sometime. And when it is, I'll let you know. good. See you next week. Okay, we'll see you next week. I'll be seeing you there next week. That'll be fun. Thanks. And I'm around all week if anybody wants to meet. Oh, and the anybody wants to look at the study guide, it's sitting right here right now. And it'll be on the website.
Organization.